Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
Chapter 1, you made it really great along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you. You said you'd stand by me in the middle of Chapter 3, but you were up to your old tricks in Chapters 4, 5, and 6. Sarah, I'm giving you a long look
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink is the name of the new memoir by Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Elvis Costello. It recounts a career that began in London in the mid-70s and took many unexpected twists and turns, leading to his work with Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Burt Bacharach, and the Brodsky String Quartet, to name just a few. The book takes a few unexpected detours as well, which makes for some fascinating reading. Elvis Costello, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
The timeline of this book, it is vaguely chronological, but you...
I would say it's not remotely chronological.
I was trying to be polite, but...
You know, obviously I've had more time with it than everybody else, so yeah. I know full well why everything is where it is in the story. And I know how things are connected. But once I'd made the decision that I was going to proceed on and write some sort of memoir, you have to decide then whether it's going to be a list of things you've done, mm-hmm. or you're going to be guided by something else. And it was more the emotions and the sensations of hearing music and how one experience led to another. So it wouldn't necessarily follow to put them chronologically. I wasn't necessarily thinking exclusively of people who had followed my career or even liked music. Necessarily, there could just be people that like to read about lives that mm-hmm. read the book. So you have to write it in a way that you can imagine the scene that's being set and sense what value or what effect it had on the writer. You know, that's the point of writing in a book as opposed to songs.
So the shape of the book, if it had been strictly chronological, you would not have been able to end with this lovely scene that you do end with, which is out of order chronologically.
Or for that matter, the opening scene, because it doesn't begin "I was born."
Right.
I mean, the opening scene locates me in the balcony of the Hammersmith Palais, a place I obviously did play in the late 70s, early 80s.
I could talk all night. My mind goes sleepwalking while I put nowhere to write. How curious information. Have you got yourself an occupation? All of this army is here to stay. All of this army on their way.
But this was my dad's place of work. That was his, predominantly his factory, his office, for most of my childhood. He sang with a radio dance band that appeared there nightly, six nights a week, and twice on a Saturday. And that's, I would go to the matinees with him when I was 7 years old and sit up in the balcony and watch the band perform for a handful of afternoon dancers.
That to me was one of the big surprises. I mean, I have been a fan since album number one, mm-hmm. since My Aim Is True. I had no idea that you came from, you know, a family of music. Your dad was Ross McManus, a singer. Yeah.
Originally a jazz trumpet player.
And he came back
from, you know, his national service. And like a lot of people, I suppose they saw a different life than the one that they had grown up in. I mean, and he heard those, you know, cues coming out of New York in the late 40s and wanted to play this new music, which was bebop. And he led I have to say, he probably didn't have a lot of competition in Birkenhead, the little town that's opposite Liverpool. He led the leading modern jazz, as they called it in England, mm-hmm. ensemble in Birkenhead. Now, that wasn't a very big club, you know, and had when he met my mother, who had been working in a record shop since 1943, when she left school at 14, he heard about this girl, a young woman who also knew about jazz and dance band music and had developed by then a pretty comprehensive knowledge of it. That's how my parents met, across a record counter. So, of course, I have a different view of you know, the mechanical things in music than somebody whose father worked in an office pushing numbers around.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about your dad, and it this becomes a salient point as we follow the many different branches of your career, is that as the 40s become the 50s and the 50s become the 60s, he still has open ears. He's still listening to whatever the new music is.
To some degree, had to.
Yeah.
Because the strange way radio was set up in the early 60s in England was that we really only had the BBC. Mm. And the BBC had agreements with the Musicians Union, the Performing Rights Societies, that only allowed them to play 5 hours of recorded music. That's all recorded music. So the rest of the musical output were interpretations of current hits by every kind of orchestra and ensemble imaginable, from palm court orchestras to the cinema organ to a dance band such as the one my dad sang.
There really are one in the air. I ring about the love between my brother and my sister.
At the same time, my mother was working in a record shop and obviously also had knowledge of the hit parade. So among my friends, my parents seemed much more, as they used to say, with it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
They didn't see a generational barrier to the music that was in the hit parade, because they were dealing with it in their work. My friends' mothers and fathers had their favorites, and my parents had their own choices of music. When I was a little kid, I was more familiar with the names of jazz musicians than rock and roll musicians, because my parents didn't listen to rock and roll, only when it was sort of forced on them in the guise of beat music in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. That's when my dad became familiar with that music.
But your introduction to the Beatles, doesn't that come through one of the records your dad...
Well, it was the first one that I ever really... The first record that I ever really got curious about. I mean, he had been bringing these records into the house in order to learn them. Obviously, he'd been doing it through my childhood, but for whatever reason, the one that I focused on, because it hit my ear, was this record, Please Please Me.
Last night I said these words to my girl. I know you never even tried, girl. Come on, 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 please, won't get like I please you.
And he would rehearse in the front room with a record player, playing the record repeatedly until he'd memorized it, and work with the sheet music and learn the melody. And his voice would vibrate the glass pane in the front room. I knew when he was at work, and I knew not to go in as well, because it would interrupt him. On this occasion, I did, and asked what happened to the records when he was done with them. And it had just never occurred to me. I don't know whether he gave them to the children of friends or whatever. Anyway, he obviously could see my curiosity in that record and gave it to me. And then that became the routine. Every week or every couple of weeks, he'd get another stack of records to learn, and I'd hope that they contained my favorites from the charts. It obviously gave me access to far more records than my friends. You know, it gave me that leg up in that respect.
And those kind of open ears, I mean, that you would later display, you know, going from rock to country to classical, jazz, ballet.
Well,
we
didn't have a massive record collection. My parents didn't have huge amounts of money, so we had a bookcase with some interesting books. We had a shelf with interesting records, and both my parents had unusual combinations of taste. There were a few classical records. There were certainly lots of jazz records, ballad albums like Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald, but also these new pop records from combos in the early 60s came into the house. And for whatever reason, maybe a little bit of local pride in the main group of the day being from Liverpool, where my mother was from. My mother was from about, you know, half a mile from Penny Lane. So, I mean, of course it registered.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs.
Another thing that people in America perhaps don't know is that most Northern English entertainers in those days were comedians. Mm. And if you wanted to fit into show business, you tended to erase your regional accent if you were going to be a singer and try to be very urbane, either terribly English or even a bit American, but certainly not talking in recognizable Liverpool accents as the Beatles did. That was sort of like, that was the big shock of them, because the only people that had done that before had been comics, you know.
Yeah. We're speaking with Elvis Costello about his new memoir, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. You use that phrase, unfaithful music, a couple of times in the book. One time you're talking about the music of Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Another time you're referring to, I think it's Danny Boy, a song that's being played outside your father's bedroom as he lays dying. What does that term mean to you?
Well, it means a lot of things. I mean, when you have a title, you hope it's going to cover a lot of the experiences in whatever it summarizes. It's the same as true when you try to come up with an album title when we made those things. In this case, I suppose unfaithfulness music would have been a better description of the Hank Williams song, and the doubt that hearing these very, very stark songs about conflicted heart brought in me when I first heard them. I didn't doubt myself quite instantly I heard them, but it put this vocabulary into my head for that kind of sensation. And when I started to, as a young man, sense that about myself, it came out in songs that had their model. They didn't sound like Hank Williams songs, of course, but they had their model. The ideal was a song like, you know, You Win Again, or these very stark songs that he wrote.
Is out all over town that you've been seen a running round. I know that I should leave, but then I just can't go. You win again.
They were among the things that guided me when I was trying to write the first songs that spoke of the heart in a conflict. Mm. The second reference that you is much later on. It's in 2010 when my father was in his last illness. And then it was that music had been all of our accompaniment. I mean, I have, in order to explain how we came to be traveling people in music, to refer to my grandfather as well, who came to America in the 20s as a ship's musician and had for 10 years a life of travel and more money than a man of his background would have expected. It wasn't a lot of money, but he dressed well. He saw New York. He brought his little camera and he took pictures of people that he encountered. And the legend of him traveling to America obviously gave my father the idea of that music and travel and some excitement and some mischief were all possible. That was my father's experience and certainly was mine. Mm. And at the end of his life, after all of this, music was still there in the room with him. Sometimes it was very comforting. Just this one occasion it turned on him. Mm. And it was horrifying to see. But the story has a kind of happy ending. He was 84 and he had an illness that erased quite rapidly his humor, personality. Anybody that knows about the advanced stages of the dementia of Parkinson's will know how horrifying it is to see a vigorous and lively personality sort of disappear before your eyes. Music penetrated that fog very beautifully until the very last moment of his life. Mm-hmm. So I'm fortunate to have been witness to that. And so if I write, if it seems a conflicted title, you'll understand why it could be Unfaithful Faithful. You know, I went back and forward. Which is it, you know?
Well, and that is kind of par for the course with a lot of the songs, especially the earlier songs, where, ironically, songs that you were singing literally were taken as irony by listeners, and then other songs that, to the point where you're singing, I'm Not Angry. And everyone's saying, listen to how angry he is.
Yeah, exactly. but, you know, that there was always a danger in that, in singing things that, in a furious way. And it is just this, there's a number of reasons why just the way I deliver things just seemed to kind of leave it open to literal interpretation. And also the times that we were singing them were those where people were literal. And it took a while, you know. I wasn't in it for 5 minutes. I didn't know I'd be able to make a living at it. I had no idea, and I didn't really have any ambitions as that I had to be this place by this time, otherwise everything was a disaster. I might have held that idea for about 10 minutes in 1978, but quickly got over it, you know. And since then, the good fortune that's come my way in working with so many different people, some of them household names and some of them people of equal musical substance, but maybe not so well known, it's just been a remarkable amount of opportunities to enjoy music, and it's carried me through. And sometimes I've had the opportunity to write things from very, very deep down inside that I didn't want to make a melodrama out of by singing for myself, but somehow could give to somebody else to sing. So the many different ways that music could serve you, or you could serve music, have been my experience.
Well, let's hear some of those ways. My guest is Elvis Costello on this special extended edition of the Soundcheck podcast. And we begin with two of the great figures in 20th century songwriting. First, Paul McCartney, with whom Elvis Costello wrote Veronica. And then there was the album with the great Burt Bacharach, and that spawned this song called Toledo.
Do people living in Toledo know that their name hasn't traveled everywhere? And does anybody in Ohio dream of that Spanish citadel? But it's no use saying that I love you, and now that girl really didn't mean a thing to me. For if anyone should look into your eyes, it's...
But as Elvis Costello said just a moment ago, some of his collaborations were with artists who were not nearly as well known as Burt Bacharach or Paul McCartney. In the classical music world, though, the Brodsky String Quartet does have a certain reputation.
She is close now. Me and my hand holding baby all walking the floor and the ceiling. And this is the song she dictated this evening.
Romeo's Seance is from the Juliet Letters, a song cycle that Elvis Costello did with the Brodsky String Quartet. And then another collaboration, and one that's kind of close to my heart, Elvis, because this is when we first met, was at intermission of a live broadcast of this piece.
Aye.
It's called Fire at Keaton's Bar and Grill, written by the sax player and storyteller Roy Nathanson.
That I could gather, still faces absent, that she could see this time harvest, that he caressed her.
That's just a little bit of the Fire Suite number 3 from Roy Nathanson, from his piece Fire at Keaton's Bar and Grill, kind of like a radio play, actually, with guest appearances by, among others, Deborah Harry and my guest, Elvis Costello, here in the Soundcheck studio. One of the striking things, Elvis, about your book is in it, you're very generous about explaining where some of the songs come from. I think it's this year's Model, which you say was an answer song to the Rolling Stones' Stupid Girl, and you kind
of—well, that's a very noble tradition in rock and roll.
Yes,
you
it
know,
is.
Like a
yeah.
bear cat answering the hound dog. You know, I mean, that was for the very beginnings. That sort of stuff. I knew about that stuff.
Right.
I didn't know the names of all those songs then, but I knew that went on. And so it's presumptuous, maybe, when you're a new group to say, well, I'll write a song that's kind of like set the record straight on this. You know, the Rolling Stones have written one.
I'm not talking about the kind of clothes she wears. Look at that stupid girl.
And there's a bit of a, you know, okay, we're coming along down the way. We're going to knock this out of the way. There's not a lot of mentors in rock and roll. It's mostly, okay, it's our turn now.
Right,
you know,
right.
In jazz and in bluegrass and in classical music, the older musicians tend to take the younger musicians under their wing, and you hear them come forward, and they're often very generous, sometimes very exacting as well,
mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
in the Buddy Rich Model, or, you know, Art Blakey, you know, having all these people come through his band, and so on and so forth. But in rock and roll, you don't really hear about that so much.
Well, know? The people who would be mentors were only in their 30s and were not ready to get out of the way, I guess.
No, and they were, yeah. But they didn't, of course, seem it to if you were 22 or 23.
Right.
You know, they just were kind of, you know, get out of the new road if you can't lend a hand, as they said.
See a picture in a thousand places, 'cause she's this year's girl.
But it wasn't just, you know, telling us this was an answer song to this other Rolling Stones song.
I would have never said that at the time, obviously, because that would have been like giving the game away.
Yeah.
It's just something to say now to make it clear the way I came to that idea of that song at all.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't have said that at the time.
You know, the rhythm from this Beatles song and the harmonic progression from that Beatles song, all that stuff.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have done that back when these records were
I wouldn't
new.
Have said it. No, I might have been doing it. And I don't even think we were analyzing it. We're often doing it instinctively. You know, the way in which now, or for 25 or 30 more years now, sampling has achieved this same effect. Of course, it's just the same, except the, you know, the technical method isn't. It's not to replay, but to actually use the clip. That's not an invalid way to work either.
No.
You know, it's a collage.
Well, I mean, a song like Watching the Detectives, I mean, that opening guitar, that little stinger on the guitar, you know, speaks so clearly of a kind of film noir or maybe...
It's not exactly any one thing, but obviously, you know, the most famous thing that sounds like that is James Bond. But, I mean, there's lots that use that signature type of sound to just create a little sense of mystery. We just had very limited resources. We just had a cheap organ and a beaten-up piano and a tremolo guitar. If I'd been recording in the 60s, there probably, you know, there would have been a string section we could have used to do the same thing the piano does, but there wasn't, so we had to do it with the means we had at hand. And it's fine. It works perfectly well.
She's watching the detectives. Ooh, he's so cute. She's watching the detectives.
One of the things about Watching the Detectives is that it you compare it in the book to, I think, Dashiell Hammett, you know, like some of those.
Well, I wouldn't compare it to, but I learned my way, I read a lot of that kind of literature, and then I saw all the films. I don't know which came first. I probably saw some of the films when I was really quite young, and then read the books, and then saw the films again. Right. And once I'd seen Gloria Graham, everything fell into place, you know. Or Ida Lupino, you know.
But that, you know, that kind of film noir sensibility, that comes up much later in the book. That recurs, that kind of
thematic
inspiration.
But I seem to be drawn to it, both for musical motifs, and particularly for as a way of telling a story. I mean, there's two or three times when I'll say, this particular story uses this language. Just as like some people write talking blueses, or there's some people write limericks. I liked the language of those type of stories as they can be represented in songs. So a song like from 5 years ago, like Church Underground.
You know my name, you don't know my mind. Don't doubt my eyes, they betray the past.
Has this similar kind of directions. One of the songs I wrote with Paul McCartney 25 years ago uses that sort of cinematic directions just for directing the listener to the story. Other than that, it is a noir story. Mm-hmm. The song I wrote for Charles Mingus' music, Invisible Lady, uses this, and this is a song about inspiration, but it makes it sound like some, you know, makes it sound like the Blue Gardenia, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah.
The naked flame flickered, clothes lie where they're thrown. That's one hell of a big torch to carry along. She might brush your face with the hem of her gown, but it's hard to wake up with your silly cracked crown. It's an empty shot glass, a shocking blue pane. The chamber rolled vacant and loaded again and again and again and again and again. Return to the invisible lady. Where are the rewards for all of the promises I made? Oh, where have you gone? I have to thank the sheet billows blank.
So let me ask you about, you said before, there are many ways that you can serve music. And, you know, you have been both a composer of lyrics and a composer of music, and a composer of lyrics and music, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So you've done the two separately, you've done the two together.
Yeah.
How different is the process? I mean, you talk about writing for a pre-existing Charles Mingus tune. That's got to be a very different thing from creating a piece.
Of course. I mean, I think the first experiences I had of writing music without any words being attached were some songs from around 1982. One, I tried to involve Sammy Kahn in writing a song. The song Long Honeymoon, that ended up being Long Honeymoon. I sent that music to Sammy Kahn in a way of building a bridge between the sort of period of songwriting in which he was best known in mm-hmm. the 1950s and into the 60s and the time I was working in 20 years later. And I couldn't seem to convey what the song was really about musically. I wasn't as good at explaining myself, I suppose. And then, you know, later on I had the opportunity to write words for other people's music, and that's for some people who are very, very protective of that music, there's a huge provocation to write music for on the themes written by Charles Mingus or Billy Strayhorn. But you know, the people who control the rights to that music could tell you to stop it. And of course, in the case of the Mingus music, it was Sue Mingus who asked me to do it. You know, the Strayhorn estate let me write words for Blood Count, which I retitled as a vocal piece, My Flame Burns Blue.
Siren's been in the radio, was humming, the sun breaking through, and a storm is coming. Scar and scar and the melody fractured, went by my window, refused to be captured. I hope I wake up in time. Good King Neptune came flipping up my street. He was a sad case, stripping up the staircase. Friends and relations laughing at my head. Battle like holes at the end of my bed. I hope I wake up in time. you can't cat, you can't quiet, the good game, you can't fight. But you might not be smart, if it's wrong, it's not right. I see it once and I see it again, now and forever and ever and then.
I wrote words for Oscar Peterson's when Summer Comes for my wife to sing at Oscar's 80th birthday, which was a, that's the only performance of the song. It's not recorded.
The land was white while the winter moon was absent from the night, and the blares only pierced by frost.
It only existed in that one moment. It was to serve that one occasion. It was a funnily enough, the sort of thing Sammy Kahn used to do all the time, write lyrics for a special occasion. Right. I got to do what Sammy did. You know, I tried to write a hopeful story for my wife to sing for Oscar, who obviously was one of her childhood heroes, to pay tribute to him. You know, and not every song has to be at the barricades, seething through gritted teeth. Some of them are seductions, some of them are tender words, some of them are lullabies, some of them are laments, some of them are bulletins, so, you know, some of them are in praise of something, praise of beauty, you know, in praise of something elusive, you know. I mean, there can be all these different reasons you sing and write.
And sometimes more than one reason in a single song. I mean,
More than one thing in a single line, to be truthful. It's quite possible. If you can do that in a painting, you can definitely do it in a song, because you have two things. You have the words and the music.
So a song like Shipbuilding, which you wrote the words for.
I only wrote the words.
Yeah. Clive Langer wrote the music. Robert Wyatt recorded it before you did,
yes,
I think.
Yes, he did. Yeah, it was written for Robert.
Well, I ask you, the boy said that they're going to take me to task. Christmas. It's just a rumor that was spread around town. Somebody said that someone got filled in for saying that people get killed in the result of their shipbuilding.
So that's, it's the Falklands War, but it's also a chance for you to work with Chet Baker. I mean,
well,
there's so many things to unpack there.
The song was written while the Falklands War was going on, but it wasn't directly about the war. It was more about the job opportunity that might have been created had the war become a sustained conflict, which it threatened to be at one point. And it was in those years that most of the northern industrial cities were being shut down. Their industries were being quite single-mindedly shut down by the government.
Including shipbuilding.
Including shipbuilding, yeah. And so just the notion that that might even be a future reality had all these contradictions in it, because people would then get jobs to build ships to send their children to die. And that seemed a better way of talking about the war than the more obvious, you know, ways that people had spoken about it before.
It's just a rumor that was spread around town. A telegram or a picture postcard. Within weeks they'll be reopening the shipyard. To buy in the next of kin once again. It's all we're skilled in. We will be shipbuilding. With all the will in the world,
the song, oddly enough, comes back to me. You know, I sing it a lot in shows, even though it's years after that event, because the paradox of that seems to work in relation to conflicts that are going on today, and it's a very sad song to sing. But the many beautiful things came out of the writing of it. You know, Clive's music was so it guided me. I don't think he thought I was going to write a lyric like that. Robert sang it so, you know, supernaturally. I then wanted to take it to an even bigger audience because I was very proud of the song and wanted to re-record it. Steve Naive had played a beautiful piano solo on Robert's rendition, so I had the opportunity to introduce another instrumental voice on our recording, which by very good fortune turned out to be Chet Baker. So I had the opportunity to work with him. And two things came out of that, that I had an acquaintance with Chet over the next few years and the last years of his life. I got to perform with him on one occasion. He ended up recording my song Almost Blue.
Which I had written with him in mind,
but never thinking I would even meet him, much less get to present it to him. And didn't actually find out he'd recorded till after he had died. But it wasn't well advertised that he was even singing the song. It was, you know, his career was very scattered.
Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here, and she's almost you. Almost all the things that you promised with your eyes, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying.
You know, I've had the opportunity in recent years to take the melodic inventions that he came up with spontaneously on that session, and when I've performed Shipbuilding with different size of group, string quartet to full symphony orchestra, I've orchestrated his trumpet melodies for as the second melodic theme of that song, and sung the song with orchestra in tribute to him, really, that say, listen what he did. He created a melody as good as the tune that Clive wrote, and he did it in a moment, and now hear it played by string section, and it will sound beautiful. And, you know, that's the best way I can say thank you, is to not just that it exists on a record, but then you can hear 30 people play it, and it will still sound magical, you know, and it was, and it's a way to keep the song kind of moving around, you know.
It also demonstrates another kind of remarkable reinvention in your career, which is you as musically literate notator of notes on the staff, you know, classical.
Well, I had no need of it when I started out.
Of course, the
materials we were working with were either pictures or just impulses. So we just did things. We didn't analyze anything we were doing. And we made these records. And then at a certain point, those formulas, those little tricks and references that we were working on would exhaust themselves because there was only so many combinations of which they could sound original. And then also some of the personalities within that group started to exhaust each other. You know, it got to be tough to be in their company. And there was less to be had out of our alliance. So we stopped working together, and I got to work with all sorts of different people who had new and different ideas about music. And eventually that led to realizing that there were even more people that I could work with who I was interested in working with, but I didn't know the language. Mm-hmm. I literally didn't know the code, which was just, it was stuff I could hear, but stuff I didn't know how to communicate, which was an idiotic oversight on my part. I'd just been stubborn about learning notation, and I learned it, you know, relatively quickly. And then, of course, then anything was possible. I could write. I learned how to orchestrate to my own satisfaction. I mean, I don't think I'd ever get hired to score the next Star Wars movie, but you know, I know how to write for an orchestra. Something that's in my head, and it will come out sounding as I imagine it. You know?
Right, and so Il Sogno, the ballet score.
Yeah, these were just episodic little themes that were there serving the dancing. They were never really intended to be a symphony. So, I mean, perhaps the odd thing was that they ended up recorded as a piece of orchestral music.
Oh,
a marvelous experience to hear these things I dreamed up, brought to life by an incredible orchestra under the baton of somebody like Michael Tilson Thomas, yeah, who's open-minded enough not to be a snob about it and say, yes, you obviously wrote this sincerely. You learnt what was necessary. You're not writing some big elaborate theory as to why this music came into existence. It has its clearly has its origins in the action of the that took place on the stage, the dance adaptation of a very well-known story, in this case, A Midsummer Night's Dream. And that's all it is. It's not pretending to be anything else. Mm. It's just some music, you know.
But it's inventively scored. I mean, you know,
some parts of it I really are fond of, and it has
the cymbalom, the zither.
I just tried to find these sounds that have always appealed to me, and then later on I wrote another piece for the Miami City Ballet for Twyla Tharp,
yeah.
And you know, then I that piece never got to be recorded, but I got to try and pit a symphony orchestra in the pit against a Latin dance band on the stage with mixed results, because I, you know, my imagining the two would be equal weight, but of course one was five times louder than,
yeah,
the other. I mean, there were things that you learn by bitter experience, but it was a tremendous thrill, you know, to do all these things. It was like...
You write, and you almost sound surprised when you wrote this sentence, that at this point you've had like double the amount of records done on the Deutsche Grammophon, the classical music, yeah, label, as you did on the famous Stiff Records label.
I only made one record for Stiff. I mean, because my managers, you know, their partnership dissolved, mm-hmm, just after the release of that first record and our first hit in England.
Turn up the TV, no one was done, will suspect even your mother won't detect it, so your father won't know. This thing
We formed another record company, and that was my foundation for through the late 70s and through the 80s, until I went, you know, signed worldwide with a major record company. When those sort of things really drove the whole show, it was the record releases that sort of that paced your tours, and you know, and
right,
and that of course has dissolved over the last 5 to 10 years, certainly maybe 15 even, you know. Mm-hmm. But I feel freer now than at any time since when I started, because I don't have any contract telling me when I've got to be anywhere. So I can do absolutely anything. I mean, I can make a record when I've just told myself I'm not going to do anymore, or I can not make a record and just play new songs on the stage or be writing them for the theater. Mm-hmm. I've been working again with Burt Bacharach for a couple of years now on musicals and songs for musicals, but you know, they take a while to get to the stage. It's mm-hmm. a process that anybody who's ever worked in a musical theatre will tell you. It's a very, very complicated process of negotiation and bluff and double bluff, and eventually you get to the opening night and you can close three nights later, you know.
Yeah. So is that okay? Are you okay with that? I mean,
the songs still exist. They I write songs for films knowing the films maybe are not going to go down in history sometimes, but yeah, there's an opportunity to write a song. The song will outlast it. I've written two or three of those, you know.
Will I recall his parting words? Must I accept his fate or take myself far from this place? I thought I heard a bluebell toll. A little bird did sing. Man has no choice when he wants everything. We'll rise above the scarlet tide that trickles down through the mountain. And
we're speaking with Elvis Costello. His memoir is Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. It's not just stories about the songs, songs that tell stories. You refer to writing short stories, And we get, at various points in the book, little fragments of, yeah, of stories.
There were just a couple of scenes that I thought were better described in a sort of fictional way. Not because I was being evasive. There was nothing scandalous. No, there was no big revelation in the identity of those people. But it was just something that occurred to me that I would write them in that way, because in the same way, as you mentioned before, some songs use words in a very literal way and others in a more an impressionistic way. For me, the scenes that I was trying to conjure up in those two or three episodes in the book, and after all, they're just a couple of pages, yeah, among 700 or however many it's supposed to be. It didn't seem like too much of a liberty to use another device. Like there's a few lines that went into rhyme, and I'm not sure anybody will have noticed them, but they are.
Oh, I noticed that. Yeah,
and you know, I didn't self-consciously write them. I found I had written them in rhyme, and then I thought, well, should I change that? And well, no, I must have done it. It's my instinct to do that, so I'll leave it like that because it still communicates the sense, whether it's in rhyme or not in rhyme. And so I didn't feel that there was a rule book about how I should write this. I mean, it's the first, and maybe it's the last book I'll write. I don't know. I don't know the future. Will I write more songs? Will I write less songs? Will I write any songs other than the ones I know I have written that haven't been heard? I mean, I can't see the future. I'd like to think there's lots more, particularly once you stop. When you complete a piece of this length, you obviously feel your head is free of a lot of stuff you've had locked up there, and it's been swirling around.
How long were you holding on to that little fact about the final Confederate ship lowering the Confederate flag at the end of the Civil War in Liverpool?
Well, I know all these. I don't know whether you know this about other places, but Liverpool has, you know, a lot of connection to Ireland, and it's a particularly, yes, Irish trait is to co-opt people. Like, you know, every American president has somehow had to come from Ireland, you know. And Bob Marley, Irish, you know. And it's almost like I think it got into Liverpool via Ireland. This, you know, Liverpool has the most listed, that is, architecturally, mm-hmm, protected buildings in England outside of London. Now, you wouldn't think that. You might think it was Edinburgh or Glasgow or one of the, you know, but it's because of the time in which Liverpool was the major port in Western Europe. And obviously there was great wealth during the days of cotton. A lot of things which are not very noble episodes in the history. And there are many ghosts and, you know, really stains is the only word for it, literally in the architecture of the city. And there's a great conflict. So it brings up the story. I mean, it is true that Laird, whose name is on one of the main streets of my dad's hometown, Birkenhead, the port opposite, mm-hmm, the main shipbuilding town on the Mersey, they did build ships. They built ships for the Navy. They built ships. They built slavers. They also built ships of the Confederacy. So they're bound up in that history, that conflicted history. They also... You know, Liverpool is the headquarters of the Battle of the Atlantic. So in terms of facing down fascism, Liverpool's got a very noble history. Mm-hmm. They survived one of the more intense blitzes outside of London, you know, which both of which my parents were caught up in, my mother being evacuated, my father actually having his house demolished by a bomb, you know, because he lived 70 yards from the docks. So, you know, it's living memory, in the case of my mother, that the reality of that. So that was what I grew up with knowing about. Mm. My grandparents and parents' generation, it was vivid. It's quite different to the North American experience where going to war was something one member of the family went overseas and fought, whether it was in Europe, whether it was in Vietnam, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq. We're talking about you're in your house and they're coming for you. So it's something that's going on right now somewhere in the world that, of course, those people have to live with that reality, you know.
So the history of Liverpool gets sort of woven into the history of
a little bit,
because
I lived there for a brief time, but I was taken as an infant, you know, like this is, I think, where I started to develop the kind of, you know, where I was born to another place to be christened. It makes you feel mythic as a child. No, I'm just kidding. No, it was simply practicality. My grandfather was in grave health and not well enough to come to London where I was born. I was taken north. So I've had a sense of belonging in London and on Merseyside ever since. And you know, with both parents coming from either side of the Mersey, that feels as much my home place as London, or the places that I've lived subsequently, Dublin, New York, Vancouver, you know. Really, I'm wherever I feel, wherever my family is, that I feel, you know, if we're not actually being assailed by people with pitchforks and flaming torches, I'm doing fine. You know?
Well, you certainly have the old Irish gift of storytelling, and the story is a big one. It's told in the book called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. Elvis Costello, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That does it for this podcast, but make sure to check out our archives of live performances, in-studio videos, exclusive music previews, and much more at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.
Every one of those late-night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes.